This is The Lack with Nina Power and Benjamin Studebaker. Today we're doing Doubt, and I'll kick us off. Doubt came out in 2008. It's set at a Catholic school in the 60s, and it's got an all-star cast. The late Philip Seymour Hoffman plays a priest. Meryl Streep is the head nun. Amy Adams plays a junior nun. Viola Davis plays the mother of one of the boys. The priest gives a sermon on doubt. The head nun is the principal of the school. She's never liked this priest. They're on different sides of Vatican II. She wonders if the priest is in doubt. Has he done something wrong? She tells the other nuns to be on the lookout. There's one black kid in the class named Donald. Donald's new at school, and he's having a hard time adjusting. The priest looks out for him. He meets with Donald individually to talk to him about how things are going. But one time, Donald returns from a meeting with the priest with alcohol on his breath. The junior nun teaching the class remembers the principal's warning and becomes concerned. Did the priest give Donald alcohol? Is there something improper about their relationship? The young nun shares her concerns with the head nun, who is immediately convinced that the priest is up to no good. But when they confront the priest, he tells them that he caught Donald drinking. He told Donald he would keep the incident a secret so Donald wouldn't lose his position as an altar boy. The junior nun believes the priest, but the head nun thinks he's lying. She shares her concerns with Donald's mother. But Donald's mother is just glad that Donald has someone looking out for him. Her husband is a violent guy, and if he found out Donald was in a homosexual relationship with the priest, he might hurt the boy. Besides, Donald just needs to make it to the end of the year. If his grades are good, he'll be able to go to a good high school. Why mess up the boy's life? The head nun is horrified by the mother's attitude, but she understands her concerns about her son's welfare. She agrees to try to keep the boy out of danger, but she remains committed to getting rid of the priest. The priest and the head nun have another meeting. The head nun claims that she's called his previous parish and had a conversation with a nun there. The nun at this other parish says he has a history of molesting boys. She demands he resign and request a transfer. If he doesn't, she'll go public. The priest continues to deny the accusations, but he does resign and request the transfer. As it turns out, the head nun made no such call to the priest's previous parish. In her view, the fact that he resigned proved that he did have a prior history of abuse. If he didn't have such a history, why would he resign? Of course, she was also threatening to take the accusations public to destroy his reputation and career. Even if the accusations were untrue, they could have had devastating effects were they to be made public. We don't know if the priest resigned because he did have a prior history or because her threats intimidated him. Ultimately, he gets a promotion. The head nun tells the bishop about her concerns, but the bishop doesn't believe her. At the end of the film, the junior nun asks the head nun, how can she be so sure the priest is guilty? After all, she never proved he was an abuser or even convinced one other person of it. The head nun claims that she has a sense for people based on years of experience, but at the end of the film, she admits that she has doubts too. She can't be sure she's right, but she feels a sense of duty to act on her beliefs. The film ends without it being made clear what really happened, as a film called Doubt surely must. If you watch this film and feel you know whether the priest is guilty, I think you missed the point. We often cannot be sure about what to do, and yet we have a conviction about what we should do. Indeed, is there really any other situation in which we have convictions? What would be the point in having a conviction about something for which we have overwhelming evidence? The word conviction comes from the Latin convinco, which means to convince, to conquer, and to find guilty. If we need to convince someone, we need to persuade them because the matter isn't clear. If we need to conquer something, we must overcome resistance. We don't have convictions about points on which there is no resistance and no ambiguity. At several points in the film, the head nun says that to pursue justice is to step away from God, but in his service. To have a conviction is to adopt a position with a level of certainty that cannot be fully justified. It is to assert that you have the truth when you have something less than that. And yet, we cannot pursue justice without conviction. So a world without conviction would also be without justice. Since justice is built on conviction, it inevitably incorporates mistakes. To pursue justice, then, is to take the view that the flaws our mistakes introduce are not so great as to invalidate the form of order we are looking to defend or establish. When the Romans conquer territory and establish order, they overcome resistance, and this overcoming involves many violent and chaotic acts. Conquest, in Roman thought, is heavily associated with pacification. To create peace, we have to make it, and the Roman state makes peace by waging war. In her pursuit of justice, the head nun doesn't just have to pursue her conviction further than the evidence alone would allow. She also has to violate the church hierarchy. The priest is her superior. When he comes into her office and she offers him tea, he takes it with 3 lumps of sugar. She doesn't put sugar in her own tea, and she would never allow her nuns any sugar. But because the priest is her superior, she not only must serve the tea, she cannot explicitly judge the priest's conduct. If she criticizes the priest for consuming sugar, this would violate her vow of obedience. She can gently mention that she gave up sugar for Lent last year, that she's out of practice scooping it, but that's as far as she can go. She only steps outside of her role because of the force of her conviction. At points in the film, the priest and the head nun get into arguments about whether sworn officers of the church should be friendly with the laity. The priest thinks rigorously enforcing the rules is counterproductive because it makes the church unwelcoming. It's clear that the priest doesn't believe the head nun really understands the role they're meant to play. He thinks she just fetishizes the rules because she's a cruel person. But if the head nun truly fetishized the rules in this way, she wouldn't be able to step outside of her role and accuse the priest. From her point of view, the rules serve a purpose, one that the head priest fails to comprehend. It is only in the service of that purpose that one may step outside them. At one point, it becomes clear that one of the older nuns is having vision problems. But the head nun makes a point of pretending not to notice this, because if the head nun's blindness is officially acknowledged, she'll be forced into retirement. The head nun still thinks this nun is effective in her role. Sorry, not the head nun's blindness, this other nun's blindness. If this other nun's blindness is officially acknowledged, she'll be forced into retirement. The head nun still thinks this nun is effective in her role, and so she finds a way to avoid enforcing the rule. She's not a cruel rule fetishist. The head nun and the priest just have different understandings of what it means to perform their roles well. But because these understandings are so different, it's hard for either character to regard the other as simply mistaken. Instead, each sees evil in the other. The head nun sees abuse in the priest, and the priest sees cruelty in the nun. Perhaps the difference stems in part from the roles the two perform. A priest has an understandable interest in church attendance, in outreach, in making people feel welcome, in making people feel comfortable confessing sins that the principal of a Catholic school might not share. At the same time, the principal has a focus on maintaining discipline that a priest might not share. I should also point out that when you are a principal and your role is primarily disciplinary, you most frequently interact with the students with behavioral problems. Over time, performing that role tends to breed suspicion. But equally, a person who has never performed that role might lack familiarity with the student's capacity to plot and scheme. A certain amount of tension between a priest and the principal of a school seems to follow from these key differences in the content of their roles. They're both sworn officers of the church, but they are in different offices that perform different functions. All this is to say that I found both of these characters sympathetic and truly do not have a sense of conviction either way. Instead, I found the film tragic. Here we have two characters who seem genuinely committed to the good as they understand it, but whose understandings are so different that they are compelled to struggle to overcome one another. It simply becomes a question of who whom. Anyway, I'll leave it there. Let's see what Nina thinks.
Yeah, I thought this was an interesting film and precisely effective in the way that you're talking about it in terms of this undecidability, this deliberate kind of raising of not just the different kinds of doubt, the different doubts that are shared or not shared by the protagonist, but also obviously on the part of the audience, and this kind of incompleteness of knowing. I thought, you know, it's obviously features some very strong actors. It has Meryl Streep and the late Philip Seymour Hoffman. And it's always very sad to see Philip Seymour Hoffman, I think, because he was such a fantastic actor. And, you know, his loss is just very, very sad and always reminds me of Mark's death for some reason. I don't know why. But there's something about that kind of genius that is very... I don't know. Some people find it very difficult to be in this world, but he always inhabits his roles so well, I think. And it's slightly unfortunate that the other role I know him for so well is in Todd Solondz's Happiness, where he plays a kind of creep. So it's difficult for me to detach the accusations and associations made by the headman, by Meryl Streep, who's also fantastic in character, from this other role, which is actually an interesting note, because it does make the point quite well that we might have negative associations with something that lead us through confirmation bias to condemn somebody for something that they haven't done. This happens all the time. Everybody does it. This person is friends with this person. This person said this. Well, we know that this person did that. Therefore, they're more likely to do this. So confirmation bias is very real. I'd just like to note that the only real piece of evidence, which I don't know if you mentioned, that she gives for the assumption that the Philip Seymour Hoffman, that the priest is abusing his role to abuse children, is that the way that another boy responds to the man touching him in the playground. She says she saw from the window. This is also an incredibly slight and ambivalent gesture, but to the head nun, this indicates a suspicion on the part of the boys towards the priest, as in they are afraid of him in this particular way, or they respond to him because he's made advances. But this is it. This is her only real claim, other than the lie of the communication with nuns at a previous place, and the idea that his resignation is a confession. I think this is a film. It's also about several other things. One of which is the world being out of joint following the death of the assassination of JFK. The film opens with the sermon talking about doubt as a form of communion and collective belonging in the face of terrible tragedy and an awful kind of shift in the horizon of things. And often when you hear people talk about this period in American history, people do talk about it like this, you know, that there was this kind of sense that the axis has shifted and that a certain innocence was lost and so on. I mean, of course, the idea that America was innocent is itself a kind of ridiculous claim. But of course, you can understand why JFK's assassination was such a big deal. The sense that the world is wrong or that something is shifting is also played out in the camera angles. Many of the scenes are played at a diagonal angle, which is quite unusual, to indicate a sort of sense of tilting or something being wrong. The weather is almost permanently windy and getting windier. Everyone is covered in leaves. There's a kind of very blatant sort of wind is coming, the winds are changing, the winds of change idea. I think as a translation from a stage play to a cinema, it's mostly effective, although I do think there is a little bit of staginess, particularly in the final scene, which reveals how traced it was from the theatrical production. That said, the sum of its parts, particularly the great acting of of Streep and Seymour Hoffman, Amy Adams, and also Viola Davis, who plays the mother of the boy in question, is all very serious and very well done. And the script is very good. The music's also by Howard Shore, who's probably the best living film composer, I would say. Certainly his work with Cronenberg's Crash, I think, is extraordinary. Anyway, so it's a serious production. And I think this, you know, the other aspect, I think, alongside the doubt which you've gone into in this question of conviction, is this idea of progress. And there's a repeated motif of the ballpoint pen. So not just the sugar, but other things that the head nun is very, very suspicious of. And it's, of course, from our perspective, 2024, being worried that the ballpoint pen would negatively affect students' handwriting is extremely quaint, right? Nobody does handwriting anymore. I was actually taught handwriting at primary school, astonishingly. I think probably people of my generation were just about taught handwriting. It was probably the last time anyone bothered to do it, using cartridge, you know, proper cartridge pens and so on. So there is a kind of general suspicion, as you mentioned, towards this kind of reforming and liberalizing of the church, but also of society more generally, indicated by the winds of change, permanent kind of pathetic fallacies going on. And this question about whether the old rules work in a new world is fundamental to any idea we have of progress, really, and whether order should be retained, or whether we should keep traditions merely for the sake of them being traditions. We're currently confronting lots of discussions about whether social media is good for young people. Most people would say it's not. Florida is trying to limit the use of social media for children under 14. It's currently passing a bill, I think. Discussions about whether to ban TikTok. Of course, there's all kinds of political machinations involved. But there is a sort of permanent tension between tradition and progress. And the liberalism represented by the Philip Seymour Hoffman character is also the fear of something like the slippery slope, that there is a blurry line. They talk about a line, where to place the line between, let's say, a singling out a pupil for particular attention because there is an absence of a paternalism, or there is an idea of compassion that the priest wants to support the boy because he is not only the only black student in the school, but he's also the victim of bullying and so on, and is potentially gay as well, which puts him also in a different and potentially more vulnerable light in multiple senses. And you can, as you say, understand the desire for compassion, the need for perhaps special treatment, except that special treatment, obviously, in some instances, can look like abuse, or indeed be the cover story for actual abuse. And of course, it's not confirmed one way or the other. We merely have hints and possibilities and suggestions and allegations and feelings and denials and so on. So I think the interesting point about order and the kind of hierarchy of men in the church is also worth noting. He sits in her chair despite the fact that he's the principal. He's ultimately promoted. She talks at various points about being the cat who's going to try to stop him. Ultimately, she cannot. Whether he is abusing his position to abuse the boys, we don't know, but she is unsuccessful in her attempt to stop him. I think the doubts that she mentions at the end, where she says, I have doubts, I think what she's referring to there are her doubts about the world to come. I don't think she means doubts about the priest's guilt, because she's repeated these assertions. I think she has doubts about how the world is going, and that this is reflected in her meditations on religiosity and her own attempt to, as you say, sidestep God or step away from God, the better to serve God, to prevent a greater harm. And the doubts I think she has are about the way the world is going, rather than her own convictions about whether harm has been committed, because I think she genuinely believes that it has, and her concern is, I suppose, recognisable, and one can empathise with her concern. Obviously, the wider context, just to wrap up, is the historical context in which the Catholic Church and some Catholic priests were indeed abusing their power in order to abuse children, right? So this is the even larger frame for the setting of the film, as well as the historical one. There is historic abuse in the Catholic Church, as there are in many, many institutions. The question of how institutions continue while recognising that they have also sheltered harm and not dealt with harm, I think is playing out all the time in many places. Lots of churches and institutions are now obsessed with safeguarding. This is really coming off the back of a long history of the idea that abusers have been protected for various reasons by various institutions for multiple different ways and for multiple reasons.
Yeah, the bit about progress, interesting point that you raise. I'm reminded of this bit in the film where the head nun says to the priest, "Why did you become a priest?" Mm. Because from her point of view, he doesn't even get what being a priest is about or what being in the church is about. So why would he even come and do it in the first place? And from his point of view, she's just someone who fetishizes the rules and doesn't understand what they're for and doesn't understand that they're just guidelines and that you have to make exceptions. And I think these are the two stereotypes that progressives and conservatives tend to throw at each other on these kinds of issues. You know, the conservative will go, "You're just an adolescent teenager who never understood what the rules were for." And the progressive will go, "You've just fetishized the rules. You don't understand their true purpose." But I think most of the time when we're having this debate among, you know, interesting people, both people do grasp what the rules are for, but they are interpreting the good in different ways. Mm-hmm. And there's a disagreement, a legitimate disagreement, about how it should be understood in this specific context.
I mean, if we have, let's take it away from criminality and so on, but if we have a general social norm that hurting children is bad and that exposing children to sexuality before they are adults is a bad thing, then the idea of that rule or that guideline is to prevent harm. I mean, but the thing is, everybody thinks they're preventing harm. And this is the problem. Everybody thinks that they are doing good. So people, you know, take another example to do with the idea of protecting children. One group of people think, well, we should give children puberty blockers. Another group of people think this is a terrible idea and a mistake and will do harm to children. Both groups will defend their position on the basis that they are doing the right thing and that they are doing good.
Perhaps a slightly less charged example would be just giving sex education to young mm-hmm. people, right? Some people think that by doing that, you're exposing children to stuff that is perverse and could have a negative effect on their development. And other people think that by doing that, you are helping children understand sexuality and making it easier for them to figure out what to do with those feelings and to comprehend them, make sense of them. There are a lot of cases of just legitimate cultural disagreement or mm-hmm. legitimate disagreement about norms that don't look honest to the people participating. There's an assumption either that the other side is ignorant or that the other side is deliberately being mendacious in its interpretation. I think that most of the time, part of what makes all of this so frustrating is that you have good people on both sides, in the sense that you have people of good character who are genuinely trying to do what they think is right. Mm-hmm. You have conflicting convictions.
What was Trump's line about the Charlottesville event? Good, with very good people on both sides or something. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. I think it was fine people or something like that.
No, for sure. I mean, this is what makes it kind of intractable. And, you know, then you have on the one hand sort of libs of TikTok gathering sort of videos of liberal teachers who look like they're actually overstepping the mark when it comes to sex ed and presenting them to a wider audience and saying, look, this is what your children are being taught, right? And, you know, and this is obviously contributing to people being riled up about it. On the other hand, you do have situations, and I've seen a few. I'm on this panel that deals with Christianity in public life and freedom of religion, where parents who have legitimate concerns are similarly treated like pariahs and ostracized and punished by the school if they want to intervene into something like sexual education for children, or if they have any problems with the material. So this does happen. I agree. I don't know how I feel about sex education. I'm trying to remember what we had at school. I mean, I suppose one of the things you might say is, in the broader sense, is why is it, well, A, is it the school's responsibility, right? Like, does the school have anything to say about this actually, right? Why, you know, is this not up to the parents if they want to say something, you know, and when they want to say it and how they want to say it? You could say in a sort of more nihilistic way, well, the entire culture is filled with sexual imagery and, you know, the culture is soaked in pornography and films that show sex. It's not like if you were trying to give a sex education lesson to a 15-year-old that they wouldn't have seen it all before already, perhaps in an even more, well, likely much more horrible way or much more unrealistic way. So isn't it better that people give positive sex education and try to move people away from negative ideas about what sex is? It's a very tricky one. Where do you stand on this?
Well, I think that a lot of the time we start, in part because people don't feel that they can win a substantive disagreement about what should or shouldn't be taught in school, purely on the basis of the principles involved. People will instead move the argument to who's ultimately responsible for the way that kids turn out. Is it the parents, or is it the school? Is it the state, or is it the family? And this pitting the state against the family or the family against the state thing is often a way of deflecting problems we can't otherwise resolve, right? We'll say, well, we'll leave this up to the families because the state can't take a position on it and politically legitimate that effectively. Or we'll say, we'll leave this up to the state because families feel at a loss about how to deal with a problem that's ubiquitous. This playing around with levels really interests me in political theory. This, you know, blaming supranational organizations like the European Union mm-hmm. for things that go on internally in a country, or blaming national governments when you're local or you're regional and you want to devolve powers to yourself. It gets away from the substantive issue. But I think it is what tends to happen because there is real legitimate disagreement on many questions. And at this point, many authorities don't feel comfortable taking positions unless there's a very high level of consensus, because there's this feeling that if you take and enforce a position that's controversial, it will just cost you too much and it won't be worth it. And one of the things that I find admirable about the nun in this film mm-hmm. is that she is willing to take a position and stick with it. And I didn't necessarily expect myself to feel that way about it. I expected myself, when I started the film, to be more on the side of due process. And I am on the side of due process. but also, there is something to this idea that, you know, if you really do think this thing happened, if you really do think mm-hmm. it happened, well, of course you would have to do something if you really think it happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the point about due process is that only makes sense if you trust the process. If the process itself is corrupt, right? Let's say the Catholic Church is protecting men who do this and it goes all the way to the top, then you can't trust the process, right? So you have to do something else. You have to create your own process. And this is what she's trying to do, I would say.
Well, and then there's the question of, can you really trust any process? You know, I think at this point, there's a lot, for instance, about forensics. You know, forensic mm-hmm. evidence is very fraught. A lot of the evidence that's used in criminal trials is based on methodologies that are scientifically circumspect. But because juries don't know this, and defense attorneys struggle to get this across to juries, oftentimes prosecutors used flawed evidence gathering methods to convict people of crimes. You know, DNA evidence, forensic evidence. And this goes on all the time. And the people who really study this stuff know that a lot of our convictions are based on flawed methodology.
Mm.
So in one sense, I think, you know, our whole criminal process is very, very flip and muddled and unclear. And yet, you know, if you take the position, the opposite position, you know, all the way, if you go all the way away from due process, you end up with something like a Cultural Revolution Maoist position of, you know, the people have a right to rebel. You know, you have a right to say that this is what you think is true and to insist upon it, regardless of who you are, because the whole system is untrustworthy on some fundamental level.
Yeah, absolutely. As somebody who has sort of watched a lot of CSI, I do think that the whole kind of criminal forensics was a psyop. You know, I think that a lot of people were memed into thinking that if you found blood and you used these techniques and DNA, you know, that these things like worked and there was like the science. and I can definitely see how shows like that kind of contributed to this this idea. I think, yeah, it's interesting. It's either the people can judge, or I think the position that a lot of people have really is that we can't judge, right? And so that we shouldn't judge. And that's in a way actually a kind of liberal nihilism, right? So the idea of the priest, let's say, you had suspicions of, but you knew that saying anything would cause trouble and you didn't. And also it's horrible. I mean, it's really difficult to accuse somebody of something, even if you have evidence or even if you think that they're doing something wrong. You know, it's not a very pleasant thing to do. Very few people want to stand up to anybody else, let alone their superior, in a workplace environment and say, I think what you're doing is wrong or you've done something wrong. So I think most people would basically refuse to judge. They would refuse to take a stand. They would pretend something wasn't happening. And this is also what the Meryl Streep nun says to the younger nun. She says at one point, you would just prefer it not to be the case. You would just prefer to believe him because it's easier, because not believing him creates a world of pain and a world of horror. It makes you distrust the priest. It makes you feel less good about the world. It makes you open to this horror that people can do terrible things and abuse their power. You know, so there's a kind of inbuilt sense in which we are often primed not to think too hard about whether somebody is doing something wrong, which turns into a kind of de facto look the other way and a kind of a sort of passive nihilism of not judging. Oh, well, who's to say that this is wrong anyway? And there's a whole grey area of social norms or people transgressing those norms, which we, I think, increasingly would refuse to take a position on because we don't know. It's not our lived experience. You know, just because we don't want to do this sort of thing, it doesn't mean that someone else might not enjoy it. And who are we to say that what they're doing is bad? And, you know, ballpoint pens, after all, aren't they quite useful?
Well, and then you know, the other part of this, too, is that if you do make a move, you're going to be in a conflict with somebody,
mm-hmm.
a conflict that could result in them contriving to have you removed or punished or dealt with harshly. And it becomes this who-whom problem. Both of them, it's very clear by the end of the film, are trying to remove the other one. And it's just a question of who will outmaneuver, because they can't say anything to each other that will change one another's minds.
Mm-hmm.
They try, and as it becomes evident that there isn't going to be any way of resolving it with discourse, they both start trying to remove each other. And this is the thing. It's not just that it's hard because it makes you have a negative view about the world, or it's depressing, or it's unsettling to believe something like this. If you really believe it, then you have a duty to act. If you act, you are now in a sharp conflict with someone that has this who whom implication to it. And that's really a tough thing for someone to take on.
Yeah, I mean, I had a situation at work when I was an academic a long time ago, at this point, and where somebody was obviously bullying me, and he was my superior, and I didn't really want to report it, and I didn't, you know, it was not a very nice situation to be in, but I kind of put up with it. And then someone else complained about him bullying me. And so I didn't make the formal complaint, but a complaint was made on my behalf, which is interesting. And ultimately, this guy was found to have bullied not only me, but like 20 other people, because lots of people came forward and said, he did this, he said this, he shouted at me, he made me cry. You know, he basically contravened the, you know, workplace rules. And you're not allowed to bully people at work. It's pretty much in every job description. It's not, you know, it's not okay to do that. And he had made me cry on multiple occasions. He'd accused me of lots of terrible things. And it was very weird. And I didn't really understand where it was coming from. And it wasn't very pleasant. But I didn't report him. I didn't bring the complaint. And I wonder why. And he lost his job. And I felt bad about that too. I didn't want this guy to lose his job. It's horrible to lose your job. And I don't know how I feel about that. I'm just announcing it as a kind of strange situation that once happened.
One thing I really like about this film is how it messes a little bit with our intuitions and the things we normally say. Because I think on this show, we've had a tendency to think about workplace as a site of corporate power, where the corporation controls the worker and subjects the worker to all sorts of arbitrary rules that circumscribe behavior much more heavily than the law itself would. And so we tend to think of these workplace disciplinary mechanisms as something that is a bureaucratic, technocratic infringement upon the freedom of the worker. And that's true in many cases. But of course, the reason you can't just scrap all of those rules is that there do need to be some additional rules in the workplace that you wouldn't put in the law to do with things like bullying. But a term like bullying is very vague and open to interpretation. Or a term like sexual harassment is very vague and open to interpretation. And I don't think anybody thinks that we should not have any rules at all regarding this at work. And yet, once you grant that you do need to have some informal rules at work that go beyond what the law would otherwise lay out, now you have a big zone of struggle where people who are good at maneuvering in bureaucratic environments can potentially get the upper hand.
Absolutely. And I'm certainly not very good at that. But it does remind me that, you know, I had a colleague who was accused of all kinds of terrible things illegitimately. And it took it turns out this woman wanted his job and she just abused the mechanism for complaint. But it was terrible. I mean, it took a year and a half to clear his name. He lost all love for the job. He was treated with suspicion by his colleagues. It was absolutely awful. And she wouldn't have been able to do this to him if those, like you say, those informal, they're not criminal, they're not laws, they're sort of gray rules of institutions. But they are completely open to abuse. And I wonder if partly the reason I didn't formally complain about this chap was I didn't want to be part of that system, right? I didn't want to use bureaucracy somehow, that my own suspicion of it, my own antipathy towards it would have been betrayed. I would have been a hypocrite had I used these gray rules to punish somebody or try to.
Do you think that maybe you have too absolute a position about the bureaucracy? I think that there's a good critique of excess bureaucratization. But does that mean that we can have no bureaucratization?
Well, I suppose what I had hoped is that these things could be resolved through human communication, right? That wouldn't invoke these formal mechanisms, right? So that you could sit down with somebody and say, or with a mediator and talk about it rather than, you know, complain. Rather than
that would be the old-fashioned socialist attitude that you can just resolve it through society and through us all just being decent people and having a conversation. But part of the reason we got the bureaucratic state is that that image of society ultimately didn't really work, at least not as well as the people who generated those theories hoped that it would.
But I think, you know, the reason why people prefer the bureaucracy is because it's less awkward. Like it's like in this film, it's very, very awkward. It's extremely awkward to accuse someone, for example, of sexually abusing a child when you don't have proof. I mean, even if you had proof, it would be unbelievably awkward to do that, right? I mean, this is
awkwardness is a big factor in our ability to talk to each other, then we don't have the kind of society that can internally resolve disputes without appeal to rules and enforcement.
Right. But then the kind of people who would abuse those rules are also those who would succeed in those bureaucratic systems. You know, like you say, the people who know how to play the system, the people who can see a way to get ahead by either becoming administrators, like many university lecturers did, or by abusing the rules in order to sort of maintain or increase their position.
Well, I wonder if there might be a moderate position here. Is there a way of having a certain level of administration in areas of life where we don't seem able to resolve disputes like anarchists in a hippie commune, right? There are clearly areas of life where the social mechanisms, social norms, we're not well socialized enough to be able to just talk to each other. This is clear. We're not functional enough to do this as people. And yet, we don't like something that's very Kafkaesque and convoluted and is so complicated in terms of paperwork and procedure that it is just dominated by effectively the lawyers, by whoever is best at manipulating complex rules. So we want some level of rules in administration, but maybe not complex. Maybe I think the problem with bureaucracy is when it becomes so complicated that you can have a major advantage if you specialize in navigating it.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, it is true. I've also had an experience, I'm not going to go into details, but of working for an organization that had kind of no rules for dealing with abuse of lecturers, right? And this was equally difficult, if not worse, because there was no formal system of complaint. There was no kind of mechanism in place to sort of deal with a difficult scenario. And yeah, I don't know. What can you do in that situation?
Well, the Catholic Church seems to have a very simple mechanism, probably too simple, which is you just yank the chain. This gets talked about a number of times in this film. If you have a problem and you can't solve it at your level, you go up the chain to the person who's higher up the chain than you. Mm-hmm. You throw it up the chain, and then the chain tells you what to do with it. The issue is, what if the person who's higher up on the chain than you is the problem? And that's where you need some additional mechanism. Now, I would think that mechanism would be the ecclesiastical court. Yeah.
Sure, but if the whole chain is rotten, that's also the problem. Right?
Yes, if the whole chain is rotten, then you've got major, major problems. But you know, the usual argument within the Catholic Church is that it's not the whole chain that's rotten. It's that there are good priests and there are bad priests, and the good priests have to in some way organize to deal with the bad priests. Mm-hmm. You know, that argument is made all the time in Catholic Church history, you know, back to the Middle Ages. You know, and Nicola Rem talking about inequality within the church between bishops who have too much property and mendicants who don't have anything. The moderate priests that are in between, they have to work together to solve this somehow. You know, the Pope has to draw on the good priests to deal with the bad priests.
Yeah, exactly. And here you also have the division between the men in the church and the women. You know, the nuns are also, in a way, at a disadvantage, even though they're kind of also integral to the church. And I think when she says, I have doubts, she's also talking about the church. You know, I don't think it's her faith in doubt. I don't think it's her religiosity, her Christianity. I think it's whether she can be Christian in this church, if the church is protecting men who do harmful things. That's I think, also what's going on here. And that there is this kind of whistleblowing possibility, but, you know, this is always the dilemma for whistleblowers, whether anyone will hear them. You know, if you're reporting to the same institution where something is going wrong, and we see this time and time again with the police, who also use the bad apple idea constantly. You know, in Britain, we had absolutely horrific police behaviour where one police officer recently, although there have been many, abused his power to rape and murder a woman and, you know, completely unbelievably horrific situation. And people knew that this guy was a wrong'un, but they didn't do anything about it up until the point in which he raped and murdered a completely innocent person by using COVID laws to take her off the street. It was horrific. I mean, really, truly, one of the most monstrous acts. But had he been stripped of his position, he wouldn't have been able to use his police powers to, you know. But this then causes problems for the whole institution, because now many people, and women especially, do not trust the police. Right, because they
right, and then what do you do with an institution that is like that? You know, sometimes people use scandals like that as opportunities to privatize the police and deunionize them, or to send the police officers to endless rounds of bureaucratic administrative training that don't really solve the problem, but do give these administrators more control and authority over the police.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ultimately, you do have to, if you're going to reform an institution, you have to go to something that's higher up a chain of some kind that has the power to intervene in that institution. There's always some other part of the state that you have to go to, or some other part of the organization. And you can't escape this. You have to go somewhere in what we have to deal with any problem in any other part of what we have.
And I mean, institutions have human beings in them, so of course they're corrupt. I mean, Agamben talks about this, Illich talks about this, you know. But I suppose one of the interesting things about the film is that there is a higher authority. There is God, right? If you know, either God stands at the top of the chain and everything else follows, and this is what the church is ostensibly supposed to be, you know, with the Pope being God's representative on earth, all the priests and everyone being in a kind of great chain of transcendent goodness from the top down, right? Ideally, hypothetically, this is, but there's also a sense in which God stands outside the law as well, like human law, because while he may be at the basis of it, ideally, human beings are also sinful and corrupt. And they can corrupt this chain. So I wonder also that if her commitment to God, as she puts it, you know, to step away from God, the better to serve him, is trying to circumvent the chain, because precisely it has become corrupt whilst maintaining her faith. I mean, I think that's very clear is what is going on. And I'm just reading the bit in the Old Testament where Moses is given the law, and the law is kind of invented in the Bible. It's an amazing scene because the law is both theological and constructed. And Moses is told, right, go and create priests, go and create judges, and they will judge situations. You can't do all of it, basically. He's overworked, you know, because he's trying to adjudicate all of these disputes between the people. So he's basically told to, actually by his, I think his father-in-law tells him he needs to basically create almost like an army of priests that are also judges. There's no difference between the priest and the
God
judge.
And God said, let there be bureaucrats.
Well, indeed. And it is basically the invention of bureaucracy. And then of course, Moses is given the commandments, and no one else is allowed to look at God because they'll be vaporized. So Moses is given these 10 commandments, and then he's basically told to tell the people, well, just follow these. Most of the time you'll be all right. And when there are disputes where both of you think that there's you're doing the right thing, or you don't know what the right thing to do is, then ask one of these army judge priests, and they will tell you.
Right. Well, this idea no one else is allowed to look at God. This is the obedience issue in the Catholic Church as well, right? One of the vows is obedience. And
yes.
The reason that one of the vows is obedience is that this idea that you go up the chain when you have a problem doesn't work without the principle of obedience. If somebody up the chain can't intervene in a problem that's lower, then you can't resolve a problem by going up. And if you have a system where when you have a problem, everybody has to turn to their own understanding or interpretation of God, then you get schism and the thing breaks apart and you get Protestantism and all of the different things that come out of that.
Yes.
So it's very difficult. There isn't an obvious or easy solution to this.
No, there really truly isn't. And human beings will constantly invent administrators and HR departments and bureaucracy. It's like a terrible thing that we do.
It's because we're not able to do this all spontaneously on our own without institutions and structures. And yet those institutions and structures have to be continuously subjected to critique and they have to be continuously rethought. You know, this idea in Confucianism of the sage being not just the one who follows the rituals, but the one who can think about when they need to change and how to change them. The sage versus the gentleman who is bound by the rules, and the sage who is allowed to update them. That distinction, I think, is very important to all structures that work like this. And I think the Catholic Church works like this. And I also think that the Chinese civil service worked like this historically, where there's this notion of, well, the people who are administrators, they've proven in some way that they're good or virtuous. You know, they've sat a test or they've been observed in some setting and demonstrated certain qualities. And therefore, these are the people that you can look to when you have a problem. But yet, there still has to be this ability to criticize the system and modify it. Otherwise, it ossifies and turns gradually into something debased. You know, the cycle of regimes in Plato's Republic is all about how you start with a system where the best people are in charge. And gradually, because they can't perfectly pick their own replacements, you get a system that has fewer and fewer of those people actually in the relevant roles. Mm-hmm. And gradually the thing becomes oriented toward reputation. Instead of having people who care about what's good, you have people who care about looking good or seeming good or being thought good. It just requires continuously reconstructing these things. You can't expect an institution to be permanently functional.
Yes, it's very depressing. I think it's very difficult also for institutions to know when they've gone wrong or when they should disband. It's seemingly impossible. So you have ossified bureaucracies. I mean, it's interesting that the final work of Sartre, of all people, was really about this problem in the Critique of Dialectical Reason when he was looking at Stalinism and wondering how the revolution had become ossified in the bureaucracy, basically. And he's trying to understand basically a kind of trying to create a philosophy of groups and how groups become static and how they stop becoming about freedom but instead become about betrayal and then, you know, the structure itself and then how the revolution recreates structure. And yeah, I think we're surrounded, well, we're always in the ruins of broken or dead or dying structures and institutions, right?
Yeah, when we keep structures around too long without changing them, I think we start to take them for granted too much. And we lose our ability to revise and update. We do need to revise and update.
Do we?
Well, yeah. The question is, when do you do it? How much do you do it? Yeah. And these are very difficult questions that not all of us are able to answer skillfully with regard to any particular institution. I think a lot of people who have no experience with institutions, but have kind of general intuitions, progressive or conservative in character, will make kind of big sweeping statements about institutions they haven't actually been part of, that they're not really intimately familiar with, you know, and just go, well, of course, the Catholic Church needs to change. Or, of course, the Catholic Church needs to stay the same. or, you know, anything, any institution, there's this tendency to go, well, of course it should or shouldn't change.
But I wonder
but
about...
really, this is always a very tough question.
Sure.
At every moment in which it's asked.
I think it's interesting, for example, with something like the Orthodox Church, that actually part of its appeal to many people, especially converts, of which there are quite a few, is that it is unchanging as much as possible.
Well, they think that. But at the same time, the Orthodox Church is explicitly under Caesar. It's Caesaropapist, so it's constantly affected by political considerations in a way that the Catholic Church is not. Mm-hmm. The Orthodox Church is very consistent in terms of its theological teachings,
mm-hmm.
but it's very inconsistent in terms of how it applies those teachings politically.
Mm-hmm.
It constantly goes wherever the emperor wants to go, or the czar, or whoever it is. And in situations where you don't have an emperor or a czar, there's a lacuna that in the church, and it starts to not function very well. The Greek Orthodox Church really struggles with that of Basileus. That's an important role in that church that doesn't exist, because when Greece became independent, they installed a Catholic king in Greece instead of putting in something that could plausibly be Byzantine.
Right. But at the other end, you've got something like the Church of England, and which is just basically like every other liberal institution, you know, and that there is very little to distinguish the church from, you know, a university or a hospital or anything else, right?
Well, that's because the monarchy in the UK doesn't take a commanding role in it. You know, the monarchy is liberal and just wants to survive and would rather stay out of disputes so that it can continue. That's why the monarchy in the UK still exists, because it has this attitude of we'll support anything as long as we get to continue.
Yeah, but I suppose it's not enough just to continue. Like, what is one continuing?
The Anglican Church reflects. It reflects the royal family's moral attitudes. It still does to this day. It is intent on continuing, regardless of whether it has any substantive content.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit depressing, isn't it, really? I mean, I love the church. I go to church. I go to an Anglo-Catholic church. It's still an Anglican church. And it's the one I go to is fairly trad. I mean, even then, it's not very trad. It's not Catholic. It's not Orthodox, right? Like, it's still, you know, liberal to some degree.
In many ways, it's appropriate. It reflects what Britain is, and it reflects what the royal family is. It does reflect on the you know, it's supposed to politically reflect the monarchy and the monarchy's attitude, and it does. So in many ways, it is doing exactly what it's supposed to do as the Church of England.
I'm not even sure it really is there for, I mean, the monarch, of course, is the nominal head of the Church of England, but it's not like there's a major anything going there, you know. I mean, the church spins on, it might mention the monarch occasionally.
Well, yeah, but that's because the monarch has this laissez-faire attitude. And I do think that's reflected in the way the church itself behaves, right? Because, you know, the head of the church is the monarch. And the monarch does have this attitude of just whatever's necessary to keep the traditional institutions going, we acquiesce, we go along.
I mean, to be fair...
And all of those institutions reflect that.
To be fair, Britain is still very good at pomp and circumstance. Like, whenever a royal dies or gets married, it has the most epic celebrations and people have the greatest outfits and costumes and, you know... So there is that. There is something to be said for pomp.
Yeah, the aesthetic.
The aesthetic.
Yeah. The Anglican Church maintains an aesthetic without much substance because that's the only way it can go on.
Well, it's better than nothing, Benjamin. It's better than nothing.
Well, yeah, I think that has been kind of the overarching theme here, is that institutions, we need them, but not too much.
Yes, maybe.
Bureaucracy, we need it, but not too much. It's better than nothing, but man, does it leave us unsatisfied sometimes. All right, we're about at an hour, so thank you guys so much for listening. We're going to go do the B-side for our Patreon listeners. Thanks again, and have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye-bye.
Bye.